Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Need expert advice on your family's health? Speak to us today at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Good morning, you're very welcome to the show. And obviously the latest events in the Middle East didn't make today's papers, but we will go to Jerusalem shortly. But first, let's have a look at what did make the papers. Bizarrely, there's a budget bonanza on the front page of all the papers today. Squeeze middle, promised tax cuts by Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil is the lead on the Business Post. Top rate entry point set to rise to 44,000 in last coalition budget ahead of the next election. The Sunday Times, Martin calls for €10 boost to child benefit. Tarnished also pledges free childcare in exclusive interview. The Sunday Independent has Michael McGrath. He's promising an increase in the state pension by at least €12 a week. Their actual lead story is explosive claims in SIPTU. So allegations will be made in a WRC case next week that a well-respected trade union official's 30-year career was destroyed after she informed SIPTU management of serious wrongdoing. The Irish Mail on Sunday is gone in a different direction entirely. Stephen Roach, I owe my ex €300,000. Cycling legend accepts French court decision against him but feels no moral compulsion to pay. I must admit, there's a very open, frank interview with him in there, and it sounds like him and his ex-partner, and it sounds like they're all being very French about everything. The Mirror is leading with the Irishman, Niall Nocton, who you will have heard on Colma Mungon yesterday, who was in the Westfield Bondi shopping centre when that awful stab attack happened. And the Sunday World is leading with cop killer secret cell tape. This is Aaron Brady. We saw him. He pleaded guilty during the week to recording an interview with a witness and sharing it online to intimidate that witness in the Adrian Donoghue murder trial. So they have that Garda interview in the Sunday World. OK, our panel are here and raring to go. Kate O'Connell is a pharmacist and a former Fine Gael TD. Ciarán Macavird is head of the School of Fiúntair and Scoil na Gaeilge at DCU. Gráinne Nié is a news reporter with the Press Association, and David Quinn is a columnist for the Sunday Independent. Good morning, everybody.
Morning.
Just before we get down to the serious business of the day, maybe we should start with, there is a very auspicious Irish journalism debut today in the Sunday Business Post, in the Business Post. I think not since, I don't know what, since Ryan Tubridy's column debuted in the Daily Mail has there been such a big day in Irish journalism. The Diary of a Taoiseach, Simon Harris's Week. Did you read it, Kate O'Connell?
I had a brief flick through it, but as someone who's fully engaged in politics, I already knew what he was at all week because we could see it all online.
Yeah.
So he's one of Simon Harris's skills is that he's, I suppose, engaged with all the social media platforms. He's probably young enough to have been a Bebo head, I'd imagine, and has, I suppose, as social media has evolved, Simon has moved with it. So the TikTok Taoiseach and his connections are very clear
but
this week.
But it's good that he's throwing a bone to legacy media as well with his explanation of his week.
Absolutely.
As well. Did you read it, David Quinn?
I did indeed, yeah. I mean, as Kate said, anybody who pays attention to politics knew already what he was up to. As you also say, Brendan, it's probably a good thing to have somebody writing in the mainstream media like that, in the legacy media. It struck me in terms of the tone, there was a sly touch of the kind of now boys and girls kind of thing to it, a kind of an excitable tone, I thought, to it. Talking about going into the Dáil canteen, talking about, you know, going into kind of this excitable way of describing how he went to Orson Luke Toronto. There was a kind of, I was still trying to pinch myself and convince myself that I've actually become Taoiseach. So there was aspects of that that struck me about it. I was trying to think of other precedents of a kind of new Prime Minister, a Taoiseach, a President writing a similar diary. I couldn't think of one. Maybe there is. But anyway, it does seem to me there was a slightly overexcitable tone.
It keeps striking me as Tony Blairish, all of this. Like, it's the kind of thing you'd imagine Tony Blair would have done. Gráinne, as a member of the mainstream media, are you quaking in your boots now if all these people are going to start filling up columns for free probably as well?
When we were waiting for Simon Harris to announce his Fine Gael candidacy for the leadership, we were wondering what medium he'd do it on. And we were like, would he do it on TikTok? Would he do it on Instagram? And it was on the sixth one on RTE. So as much as there is this talk of a TikTok Taoiseach, to do the serious work, you kind of have to do it in a serious way. And maybe that doesn't come across as well on TikTok. But it's an interesting kind of personalised approach. You know, we talk about the kind of dehumanising of politicians when people are so frustrating. It is very humanising. Like he talks about in the Dáil chamber when he was voted in by TDs as Taoiseach, throughout the speeches, I can hear his son Killian calling my name, which is such a visceral sort of moment that we can all kind of get a glimpse into a bit what it was like for him.
Do you think he should do it every week?
I don't know if that's where his energy should go, let's put it like that. But it is
he
an
has
interesting
a lot of
insight.
It, though. Yeah, he has a lot of energy.
Yeah, that's when the excitable tone.
Do you like
might
it,
Ciarán
Lochaber? Do you think this is a good development?
I think so. I was expecting, as Grainne says, on TikTok maybe, because he has 300 videos on TikTok. But as you said in your piece, Brendan, he seems to be always in a hurry. And I suppose that the diary gives vent to, look, this is what I'm doing. I'm in a hurry. I'm doing all this. But he is a very large social media has formed a large part of the way he gets his message out. So he's got 100,000 followers on TikTok. He's got 250,000 on X. How has he got? Adrian Weckler brings up the question today in the papers, like, is this a threat to security that he's on TikTok so much? But he doesn't have much time. How much time is he going to have to invest in his social media? Like, he's only got the local and European elections are on the 7th of June. He said he'll visit every constituency between now and then. He's got European meetings next week. He's only got 88 days until the recess of the Dáil on the 11th of July. So he's going to be very, very busy.
Okay, so let's reflect on that on the first week according to other people. Then there's his version of it. Kate, there is Hugh O'Connell's kind of version of it then in the Sunday Times. New energy but same old party politics. You pick that.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's one of the challenges for Simon Harris and for Fine Gael is that nothing can undo the fact that Fine Gael have been 13 years in government. So as a nod to kind of the new Labour thing that you referenced at the start, what Simon Harris has to do is to have a very much a defined leadership, that he changes the tone, the speed, and he's done that, and I suppose the vibe around Fine Gael. And he's going to have to do that very quickly if it's to change, turn the ship before the local elections. And then he has the big general election in his sight.
So now, a lot of people would have said the word bottled it is around a lot today in terms of when you talk about changing the vibe, that I think a lot of people felt that one simple way of changing the vibe would be to do as was expected and move Helen McEntee out of justice. And there seems to be a suggestion that he was going to do that. Francis Fitzgerald, it is suggested, interceded, and that he then, quotes, bottled it.
Well, that's rumour. And the only people that know exactly what went on there is the leader of Fine Gael, Simon Harris and the Taoiseach, and Helen McEntee. In terms of his move towards his changes at Cabinet, the two men that he promoted, Patrick O'Donovan and Minister Peter Burke, both are coming from, I suppose, a huge amount of experience in politics. Both served at local level. Patrick O'Donovan was elected at the same time as Simon Harris. He's an industrial chemist. He's very much suited to the role he's been given. And Peter
Burke.
So
in all that shuffling around, there were two men promoted. How do you feel about that?
Well, he only has what's available to him, and if the people are the people that elect the members of the Dáil, and it's up to Simon Harris to pick from what he has, and he did his best with what he had. I think there's a net improvement in female representation with the appointment of Eimear Higgins to a Minister of State post, but he had two talented men to promote. He promoted them, and he kept the status quo. And I suppose decided not to upset the apple cart too much. He was conservative in his approach, but he did pick two very capable young men.
Two men that
are going to run again, and two men that are, I suppose, heading into the career politician mode. They're very much dedicated to public service. Patrick O'Donovan is based in Munster.
Point taken. Grainne, you picked that piece as well, New Energy but same old party politics. So what was the view from the kind of political correspondent, journalist kind of...
I suppose it is, as Kate was saying, like they have been in government a lot for a long time, and Simon Harris has been a very savvy media performer. He has been well able, for example, in the justice brief for dealing with quite knotty issues when he was in that for a time. But there's an interesting piece in one of the papers in the Mail about how the tone, even in response to his social media, has changed since becoming Taoiseach. It is all rewritten. The kind of script has changed now because he is the lightning rod for public dissatisfaction as well as expectation about how things get better. So he also has to straddle this line of differentiating Fine Gael from his coalition partners while also working with them to achieve progress for the next election. It's a tricky balance to get.
So right. is that what's going on today with all those front pages about the budget as well? This is now Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael jockeying for position and starting to split up and take credit for things. Can you run us through what we learned today about the budget?
So there's a couple of different pieces. Let's start with the Sunday Times. Martin calls for €10 boost to child benefit, and there's a range of different policies announced in there, but he suggests that free universal childcare will be included in the next Fianna Fáil manifesto, so that might hint at where priorities will lie. There'll be a €12 pension boost, and winter energy credits are being looked at, but they kind of haven't decided on whether they'll be in. He hasn't ruled it out. So that's in the Sunday Times. In the Sindo, Philip Ryan has an interview with Mike McGrath, and they talk about the one-off payments are unlikely to be rolled out again. So they're considering the energy credits, but unlikely to have the one-off social welfare payments that we saw in previous budgets. And they'll be looking to introduce further reductions to the USC. He also said that there is a planned reduction in the PRSI rate, but they're still examining that, and they intend to increase the rent credit from €750 currently. They increased that in the last budget as well. There is also on the front page of the Business Post, they're talking about promised tax cuts by two of the coalition parties, Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil, for that squeeze middle. So you mentioned it in the paper front page roundup there, up from the entry point to the higher rate of 40% tax would go from 42,000 to 44,000. So you can see this is, we get criticised all the time when we ask ministers about budget stuff, and they say it gets earlier and earlier every year. Like this is a lot very early in the year
April bonanza here.
that I should mention, the Michael McGrath interview promises a pre-election giveaway as well. So that all feels very election focused.
Okay. And David Quinn, I know you want to come back to talk about the childcare aspect of that, but just on back to the Taoiseach's first week, you picked Shane Ross in the Sunday Independent, New Kid on the Block, as some growing up to do.
Yeah, because Shane Ross is pretty critical of his first week, and particularly over the decision not to move Helen McEntee. So Shane Ross is making the point that Simon Harris, this is before he became Taoiseach, after Leo had announced that he was going, was making a very big deal about the law and order issue. And so that obviously means people's eyes are cast towards the Department of Justice. Because if you want to make kind of a big announcement and do something important and signal to the public that you intend to have a new broom, well, then you don't leave your Justice Minister in place, who was under heavy criticism, rightly or wrongly, for failing on the law and order issue. And he left her there. And of course, she was also coming under criticism, and this included from within her own party, from the likes of Charlie Flanagan and Michael Ring, on the hate speech issue. And so that was the big one that he, people were thinking, If you are going to make a big change and you're not simply going to be as safe as possible, which he was in the end, then you've got to move Helen McEntee. And Shane Ross seems to be of the opinion that, that Jennifer Carroll McNeill was the person to move in there. I see Hugh O'Connell in the Sunday Times and Claire Scott, who wrote that piece people have already referred to, are saying that he was thinking of this as Simon Harris of Heather Humphreys, but Heather Humphreys didn't want to be moved out of the Department of Social Protection because she thinks she still has things to do. But I'm sure Jennifer Carroll McNeill would have been delighted to get to the Department of Justice, and then he could have moved Helen McEntee to something like higher education or enterprise. So he moved, obviously, the two guys, Peter Burke and Patrick O'Donovan, into those posts instead.
Kate, was Jennifer Carroll McNeill disappointed in all of this, do you think?
I don't know. I imagine she probably lobbied for the position, but she didn't get it. That's just the way it moves. And Jennifer has a history. She worked with Frances Fitzgerald as an advisor. She worked with Enda Kenny, so she's well experienced in the Department of Justice, and she's legal by her profession. But that's just the way it rolls in politics. When it's your time, it's your time. And it wasn't Jennifer's time this week for cabinet.
Do you think was she being punished for thinking of a leadership bid herself? She apparently made a few phone calls and did think about it.
I wouldn't see that in Simon Harris's character to punish somebody like that.
Ciarán, you also picked the Shane Ross piece and the Hugh O'Connell piece about the Taoiseach's first week.
Yes, I mean there weren't any great big shake-ups. There was nothing major there to upset the apple cart. I mean, when we think back, I suppose the last huge one was Albert Reynolds when he came in and he made the quip he needed a revolving door. He had made so many changes but again, Simon didn't have many places to. He didn't do much really, and even the Minister for the Gaeltacht, he decided to pass over it, and he actually assigned it to Thomas Byrne, which is fantastic because Thomas Byrne is fluent as Gaeilge, and he had no candidates within Fine Gael.
So as a Gaeilgeoir, do you think that people will feel that Fine Gael had nobody for that?
Well, there's a bit of it. Maybe nobody wanted it within Fine Gael, but it's fantastic that we do have a Minister for the Gaeltacht.
Who seems very enthused about it.
Very enthusiastic, and he's fluent as Gaeilge, and he performed very well on TG Cahir on the night. So I wish him the very best.
Okay, Kate, the Mail on Sunday, John Drennan has a piece on page 9 that you've picked. Harris is facing the horror scenario of losing half his TDs before the election.
Yeah, this is going to be perhaps, I suppose, in tandem with all of the international pressures, this is going to be the biggest challenge for Simon Harris is getting the election candidates on the ground and ready to run campaigns in advance of the next general election. He has lost, I think it is, are we at 12 or 13?
Yeah.
Sitting
and
TDs.
Like according to the speculation there, it could be up to 20.
Yes,
by the
there's
time
a few more that are suspected to be going. There's been a sort of slow drip of resignations or declarations that people won't run. And it's always a challenge to take a seat.
But this is an extraordinary one. This is over half the sitting TDs could be gone.
Yeah, it's really challenging for Simon as a leader. But sure, look, if he reaches rock bottom with it, the only way is up. And I think, as we've said at the start, I mean, he has the energy to do it. He will put in the work. He knows the party. I mean, Simon is active in Fine Gael over about 20 years at this stage, since he was 16 or 17, maybe a bit older. So he knows all of the members, as in the actors within the party. He's familiar with headquarters, and he knows what has to be done. And I was at the Ardèche, I think was that last weekend?
Oh, only. We all noticed that you're at the Ardèche.
And, what is refreshing
was there
is
an element of choir boys about the way Simon Harris took over and then the Ardèche and everything.
Oh, sure, look, I mean, that's how you do it, right, Brendan, you know?
Really, I thought you were against the kind of a choir boy situation. Okay, right.
Yeah. Once bitten, twice shy.
Okay, yeah.
So, I mean, I do think it's going to be a challenge for him, but he's up for the challenge. He knew this when he was, this is not a surprise to him. The attrition rate within the party was evident before he became leader. It perhaps
What's
contributed.
What's the problem there?
Well, it's hard
it's
to know.
It's not happening in any other party, is it?
Yeah, but you do have a chunk of TDs that have been around a long time. I mean, if you're in government that long, there's a chunk that have served at cabinet level. There's an age issue there with some people just deciding they've given it enough. And even if you look to the likes of Leo Varadkar and you look to the likes of Brendan Griffin, all men in their prime, they have given a chunk of their lives to the country, Leo in particular, and TDs from further down the country with children. So, you know, you can't question, I suppose, their personal decisions or their personal lives. I mean, Leo would have made huge sacrifices in his personal life. I consider all I've done in the last 20 years, and I'm give or take the same age as Leo, you know, the burdens on himself, his family and his relationships must have been great.
Listen to you.
Yeah, well, it is the truth.
Okay, yeah.
Politically, we might have seen eye to eye, but personally, I'd have the time for it.
Okay, yeah, because I thought it was not dramatic, like, but it was a very strong thing to say that you said it was the end of a dark period in your life when
well,
Leo
I mean, that's
Varadkar
not just
left.
Leo Varadkar's doing. I mean, I am a community pharmacist. It's almost 5 years since COVID. We've been working at the front line in a pressurised scenario since then.
Okay.
That came off the back of losing
but,
a doll
but part
seat.
Of it was Leo Varadkar's leadership.
Of course
leadership.
It was a contributory factor.
It was a dark time for you, yeah.
Well, I mean, it depends what your scale of dark is. I mean, you know, sort of a shade of grey maybe, but not blacked out, Brendan.
Okay. But were you delighted when he stepped down?
Well, I wasn't delighted. That's the wrong word, but I do think
thrilled?
That... I do think for me, you know, there wasn't a path forward with Leo as Taoiseach as leader of Fine Gael. There is a path forward now within the party.
And now that you've joined the choir again, will you be running in the upcoming general election?
Well, that's up to the National Executive and the Taoiseach.
Anything said so far? Have you had a conversation?
Plenty of conversations have been had. But the focus is on the local elections.
Does the Taoiseach want you to run?
Well, sure, we'll see. The Taoiseach wants to win seats. And as leader of Fine Gael,
he needs candidates.
He needs candidates and he needs to win seats. And I will do whatever I can for Fine Gael to win as many seats nationally.
Ronnie, what's your analysis of that now? Give us a live analysis of what just happened there.
Like a running commentary on the sport.
That's folly.
But
it is
a good point about the attrition. You know, there is a kind of a panic in terms of how much the party can rebound when you're in government for so long. And even as a new leader, how much energy you can inject when the party itself feels very tired, obviously, the parliamentary party anyway. The thing Simon Harris said about visiting every constituency in the country, is that about kind of shoring up support, trying to pick new candidates that would kind of revive the party? And that is the new energy, the new revival that would happen. And remember, Simon Harris got involved in Fine Gael because that's similar to what happened to him. Enda Kenny spoke to him when he was a young man and said, Fine Gael is the party for you, and Simon Harris joined. So is he trying to kind of mimic that across the country with local elections? But there has to be a kind of an appeal to the voters. You know, I see childcare, I see housing. A renewed focus on that is definitely a man who has children, a man who is hearing repeatedly, these are the issues that matter to ordinary voters. And they're very hard to deliver upon in a year. That's probably, I think, why there was so much caution in the reshuffle.
Yeah, Ciarán.
No, I'm delighted for Kate and I wish you the very best of luck. No, it's terrible to see when you see talent sidelined in teams or parties or organisations because people don't get on or just don't like it. So I wish you the very best
Thank
of luck.
You.
But
what about the state of Fine Gael then, like with losing possibly half, possibly more of its TDs and only, you know, months to galvanise?
I understand it, as Kate said, because some of them have been around a very long time. Richard Bruton's among them as well. And for the abuse they get on social media, I see a lot of female politicians coming forward saying they get a lot of abuse in social media. And I can understand it from a personal point of view. And I think I can understand Leo Varadkar from his personal life point of view. He wants to have a life, you know. But
so is it becoming less attractive in general for smart, talented people? present company excluded.
I don't think so, but I think there's a huge opportunity here as well, Brendan, for Fine Gael to source new candidates, to get new younger candidates to replace some of what may be titled, excuse me, the grey brigade that are tiring, or the tired old faces.
Rejuvenation, as Leo Varadkar constantly referred to.
Yes, yeah. The tired old faces around the cabinet table. I mean, it's interesting, the piece in Sunday Times, Hugh O'Connell, new energy but same old party. I mean, that's kind of the view. And when I looked at it, you know, when Simon came into the leadership, you look at him and you go, oh, you know, but he's been around a long time. He's been a TD for 13 or 14 years. He's been a minister since 2016. So it is a chance for them to get new candidates, new younger candidates maybe. An uphill battle though.
Yeah, yeah. David, will you briefly tell us about Aidan Regan's piece? Because I do want to get on to then the timing of an election. But Aidan Regan has a really interesting piece in the Business Post today about the dilemma of Fine Gael centre-right politics is dead unless a generation own their own homes.
Yeah, so I think his big point is that if you think that housing or, you know, even rent of an apartment is out of reach, then you have no reason to vote for establishment parties. So you're going to be naturally then drawn to anti-establishment parties. And they might be left-wing parties, or they might be these populist right parties, or they might be the independents here in Ireland. But I think he's absolutely correct about that. And so his solution is obviously, and everybody agrees with this, is we got to build as many houses as possible to make housing accessible. I mean, we see all the Irish going out to places like Australia, even though, by the way, housing is extremely expensive there as well. So they must see other aspects of the lifestyle which are attractive. But he kind of goes through the kind of list of issues that a centre-right party might try to reach out to voters on. So he addresses, for example, the issue of immigration. And he said that that's a slightly tricky one for a party like Fine Gael.
Yeah.
Because they can say, well, okay, we're going to be a little bit more restrictionist. But on the other hand, they might begin then to lose some of their urban liberal voters if they do that. So he says you might actually lose as many votes as you gain. So that mightn't be as much of a way forward as a party like Fine Gael might think. And that's why I guess he thinks that the path of least resistance politically, even though there's many practical obstacles in the way of building enough houses, is to try and solve the housing crisis. I mean, it's the same problem the Tories have in Britain.
And he does, Aidan Regan points out, this is a problem for parties like Fine Gael all over Europe, right? That like, so I suppose it comes down to, what is Fine Gael now? Is it a back to basics law and order party for respectable middle class blue shirty kind of people? Or is it you know, a young liberal Simon Harris-y kind of progressive party? What is it?
Well, historically, Fine Gael has, to my mind anyway, as a Fine Gaeler, has always somehow balanced progressive social issues while being fiscally conservative. And we heard talk about the woke agenda, whatever that is, or Fine Gael going back to roots. I do believe there's a group within Fine Gael that although they had to go on huge journeys when it came to issues like Repeal the Eighth and marriage equality, that they never felt they got the recognition in the ballot box for such progressive acts. I do think Harris, because of a perceived disconnect between the party leadership and rural Ireland, be that the farmers and across the country, small and medium enterprises are suffering. I do think, and law and order. So looking at farming and rural Ireland, looking at, I suppose, reconnecting with those communities and responding accordingly. Much of rural Ireland feels very abandoned.
It's all tricky though, isn't it? Yeah, but they feel abandoned because a lot of it is to do with the Greens and the Green agenda. Is Fine Gael going to start turning on that?
Well, there is a difference between the Green agenda and actual real-life climate challenges that are happening. And I think that the key to Simon Harris's success when it comes to rural Ireland is taking those messages from Europe with regard to rewilding, rewetting and maintenance of our ecosystems, that we make it attractive to rural Ireland. That rural Ireland don't constantly feel like they're being dictated to from government or from Europe, that rural Ireland feel listened to, and that farmers and rural communities are engaged with and contribute to policy, Irish policy, bespoke Irish policy when it comes to community climate and farming.
Okay. Let's talk about the timing of the election. Ciarán, you picked a very good piece, actually, in Sunday Independent by David Davenport. He's still got it. Taoiseach might do well to heed Willie O'Dea's advice and go for an early election, he's saying.
Yes, he's calling for advising Harris to go for an early election, as did Bertie Ahern during the week. But
I think Bertie Ahern was saying it again at the Ardesh last night.
He was, yes. But I cannot see, given our previous comments on the lack of preparedness, perhaps, for Fine Gael, because of so many candidates aren't running again. The European and local elections are on the 7th of June. It's hard to see, and the Dáil is going for recess on the 11th of July. It's hard to see when you would have that election. But Bertie's comments, you know, you better do it in the good weather, you know, when the days are longer to give you. So maybe September, October, but the budget is in September. And as we can see on today's front pages, they're promising the sun, moon and stars are
so
promising.
Courtney, does this suggest they'll go fast after a budget?
I think so, yeah. I think that's that. Or now, in fairness, there is suggest the Harris thing has shifted things because he'll have such a short tenure in office. So you're relying on a certain amount of progress in that time. So it does push the timeline out to like February, maybe. But it definitely is in that window, I would say, between post-budget and February, that an election could be called, and it could be prompted by any kind of political issue that comes to the fore as well. There's a great quote in John Drennan's piece in the Mail with some of Harris's supporters about an election that they can't be predicted, and that Harris is very adamant that there will not be an early one. He said he doesn't want to be some sort of a blip or cipher for a couple of months and end up being the answer to every pub quiz as to who was the shortest serving Taoiseach ever. And then another source says, let's be utterly clear here, he doesn't want to be a Liz Truss. So yeah. I think that is like a powerful indicator.
So Kate, the thing is though, going back to what you were saying, it's very interesting what you say about vibes, because vibes, feelings are probably more important to people than facts, right? He doesn't have enough time maybe to do anything substantially. Mm. If he can change the vibes, that has a certain lifespan. Might he be more inclined to kind of go early while there's still a vibe, a bang of new about him?
Yeah, he could. There is a possibility that on an upward trajectory and with a positive vibe around him, and if there's no sort of wild cards thrown into the mix, that if the Harris hop happens, that he may decide to go, and they may even pull an early budget and go early.
What are you factoring into your own thinking in terms of life planning?
I've only the rosters done for another few weeks, Brendan, so I'm fairly flexible.
Okay, you're flexible, are you?
Yeah,
all right.
Fairly flexible.
Okay. David, just before we leave this, John Drennan in the Mail, independence to soar from 22 to 37 seats.
Yeah, I mean, so he's kind of saying that, you know, who will be the main block of TDs outside of Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael? And, you know, will it be Sinn Féin or the independents? And so it looks like they'll be neck and neck. So he's saying that they're quite likely to go from 22 TDs to 37, which would be an incredible block of TDs to have. I mean, Ireland is kind of, you know, we can have mixed feelings about the independents because it makes it harder to form coalitions and it makes future governments more unstable. But on the other hand, what Irish people seem to be doing is they're not going for a kind of big populist right party, like we'll say the Popular Front and Marine Le Pen in France. What they're going for is the independents as well. Something equivalent roughly to the citizen farmer movement in Netherlands, which, by the way, is headed by this lady called Caroline van der Block, is it? And she is
second generation Irish.
Yeah, exactly. So I think we're kind of fortunate in that the independents are acting as a kind of safety valve for that kind of populist vote. And I presume what will happen after the next election, if they are as powerful as they look, that whoever wants to get into government will be speaking to certain blocks of these independent TDs with a view to offering them cabinet positions. But I think also Irish politics is increasingly moving in the direction of countries like Belgium and and Netherlands and Finland, where you vote for a particular party and you have no idea what government you're going to get once coalition negotiations begin. I think it's going to become extremely unpredictable, and it's going to actually be extremely hard for Irish people to vote for the kind of government they actually want, because there's going to be so many smaller parties, so many independents, and it just becomes very uncertain who we're actually voting for in terms of a government.
I don't think Ireland has figured out its political system separate to the Civil War era yet. Like, we don't have parties that kind of represent an ideology as much as there are two major parties that kind of reflect as much as possible what the voters want at any moment.
Steady on there kind of thing, kind of, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think and we change. Haven't really, like, it is really hard to tell with the two major parties their history is one thing, but where they could go to, you know, Fianna Fáil has the exact same issue in terms of how do they appeal to young voters? What is their message to young people so that they vote for Fianna Fáil? No, I don't know anyone my age who would be appealed.
But I think, Ronnie, you see, I think going forward, it's entirely possible we will not hit periods of kind of stability again for a long time. Mm. I think this is the point, like, it's all breaking down. I mean, the mainstream parties like Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael are nowhere like what they were, and it's very hard to see them making a proper comeback. And so we don't go back to the days of the kind of 70s, 80s, 90s, where it was very predictable if you voted for this party, well, then you were going to get that particular government. I think uncertainty is kind of the mode going forward, and I think it'll be for quite a long time to come.
And it's going to be very difficult when we don't have any basic services in the country to make progress in those issues like health and housing, which is to the fore of so many people's minds.
Okay, it was all going so nicely there for a while. I'm going to take a break to get this negativity out of the air. Kate O'Connell, Kieran McInvard, Grainne Nia and David Quinn are staying with us. We'll be back in a minute.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Our panel are still with us. Kate O'Connell, Kieran McInvard, Grainne Nia and David Quinn. And guys, I'll ask you to put on your headphones there now. And of course, people listening will have seen the images on television this morning of events overnight as Iran launched drones and cruise missiles towards Israel. So before we came on air, I spoke with Gershon Baskin, and he is the Middle East director of the International Communities Organization, and he is in Jerusalem. I asked him this morning, what the mood is in Israel this morning.
Well, I would say people are rather elated by the fact that Israel's defense system, together with the alliance with our neighbors and the United States, proved almost 100% effective. It's quite amazing with the amount of drones, rockets, missiles that were sent to Israel overnight, that there's no casualties. There's one Bedouin girl who's in critical condition, whose house was hit, and there's a little damage to one of the army bases, but that's it, which is quite amazing.
So was there substantial fear last night in that kind of interregnum time between when we knew the missiles and drones had been launched and then Israel sitting there waiting for them to arrive? Were people afraid?
I think that there was fear. I can testify from my own house and other friends and neighbors. People were bracing for the hit. Everyone was prepared. Most people in Israel know what they have to do and how to behave. We've been through rocket attacks before. Many people, if not most people, have bomb shelters in their homes, like I do. And we were prepared. At about 2 o'clock in the morning, I heard booming above my head in Jerusalem before the siren went off, and there were several explosions right above our house, and then the siren went off, and my wife didn't hear the booming. She woke up from the sirens, and we went down to the bomb shelter and stayed there for 10, 15 minutes, and that was it.
Okay. So look, as a peace activist, and you've acted as a negotiator for both Israel and Palestine, so you're well placed to give us a read on the broader picture here. What's your read of the meaning of all this? How much has the ante been up now?
Well, I think that Iran is claiming that they got their revenge. I've heard reports from Iran that they're claiming that they, through cyber attacks also, shut off the electricity in half of Israel, and that their bombs were effective. This is, of course, not true, but it's good if Iran thinks so, or at least the regime tells the people that. What's needed now is time for strategic thinking and not revenge from Israel's part. Israel still has to decide what it's doing with the future of Gaza, and that needs to be the main focus of getting the Israeli hostages home and figuring out how to end this war. Our prime minister still refuses to put on the table a political solution to the war, which is disastrous, and just another reason why he's not worthy to be prime minister anymore. But that's our major focus right now. And of course, preventing the war with Hezbollah in Lebanon. This has to be the main focus. We don't want a regional war. We need to capitalize on the alliance that was demonstrated last night by our neighbors helping us to shoot down rockets that were pointed at Israel. That was not totally expected, but certainly something to pay attention to.
Okay, so on one hand, if Netanyahu was to be sensible, he would say, here I am back in the bosom of my neighbors at America, and it would be foolhardy to ruin this kind of goodwill, if you will, by doing something rash back. But on the other hand, knowing the type of person he is, do you feel he may be tempted not to leave it at this?
Well, he will be tempted not to leave it at this, but I think he's going to hear President Biden's famous one-word sentence of don't. And the Americans stood by Israel last night. They were responsible for shooting down a lot of the drones that were headed toward Israel. The Americans definitely have Israel's back, and they don't want Israel to go on the offensive. So I think there's going to be quite a debate within our society, and particularly within the War Cabinet, where there are a few more rational minds and less politically focused on their political careers, then hopefully those voices will be louder than Netanyahu's.
Okay, you're very hopeful, I must say. Gershon, does this change anything in terms of the broader dynamics within the region?
I'm afraid it doesn't. Until we deal with the core issue of the conflict in the region, which is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, we're still going to have Iran and its proxies using the Palestinian issue as an excuse for attacking Israel. In reality, there is nothing in conflict between Israel and Iran. The Iranians use their fanatic religious ideology and their support of Palestine, their so-called support of Palestine, to call Israel the little Satan. We know there are a lot of people in Iran who are against that horrible regime, and the whole world needs to find ways of supporting them. There needs to be a change in Iran. We need a change of regime in Israel. The Palestinians need a change of regime. We need a whole lot of new leaders.
Okay. And in the immediate moment that we're in now, I suppose a lot of people have made the point that Iran and Israel have been in a kind of, I heard it described as a warm war for a long time. This is a new situation now where we have an attack from Iranian soil to Israeli soil. How dangerous a situation do you think the world is in right now?
Well, I think it is dangerous if Israel decides to attack Iran now and get revenge. Iran doesn't have an air defense system like Israel does. And if Israel shoots rockets and bombs at Iran, people are going to die. And that's escalation. That's why I said we need to think strategically now. Israel has lots of non-lethal ways of sending Iran a very strong message that Israel has the ability to get its revenge, but it doesn't want to kill people.
Okay, Gershon Baskin, Middle East Director of the International Communities Organization, thank you very much. So, Ciarán MacInvird, if we take it back from the moment and what Gershon Baskin kept saying there is that the only answer to all this is fundamentally back to there needs to be a political solution to this. You picked Colin Murphy's piece in the Sunday Independent today, Momentum to Put Two States in Place Grows.
Yes, on page 25 of the Sunday Independent. And he poses the question at the start, is there any cause for hope? And over the last number of months, it's the kind of predictable way this has gone on is the attack on Gaza is it's a little depressing. I mean, residents returning to Khan Yunis earlier this week said they didn't recognise it. 80% of the buildings had gone. The only
60,
way,
I think, 60 yeah, damage.
But the only way forward is peace and reconciliation. And if you go back, I mean, if you go back, say, the Camp David Accords of 78, Madrid Conference of 91, Oslo Agreement 93, Camp David in 2000, Annapolis 2007, and Washington 2010, there hasn't really been any move towards peace or peace talks since Netanyahu has been in power. The last 8 to 10 years really have been devoid of a move towards peace. Nobody's talking about peace. People are talking about retaliatory strikes. I mean, Iran did this because Israel bombed the Iranian consulate in Damascus. There are raids on Syria over the last couple of years that go unreported in the media. But nobody is pulling back and calling for peace. No, like, it doesn't even come into the equation. It's more weapons and more money for the military effort. And I suppose it's very on page 25 of the Sunday Independent today. It's like ne'er the twain shall meet. Alan Shatter poses, you know, says, well, no, we can't really recognise the Palestinian state, and yet Rosita Sweetman comes from the other side and said, yes, it's the only way forward. And I think Simon Harris has to be complimented on being very strong on this. In the last week, he said the two-state solution was the only way. He spoke with the Spanish Prime Minister in bringing forward a European proposal for a two-state solution, and he said it at the Fine Gael Ardèche as well. But there needs to be very urgent move for an international effort towards a peace agreement.
Okay. David Quinn, you also picked Alan Shatter's piece.
Yeah, so I mean, Alan Shatter is in favour of a two-state solution. He just thinks that it's premature in the case of Ireland to recognise the Palestinian state. I see in the Sunday Business Post editorial has taken a roughly similar line, that we should wait to move in tandem with the European Union. But I think that Irish foreign policy in general needs to be more even-handed when it comes to the Middle East. So we can't be putting all the moral pressure on the Israelis. I'm not just talking about this war, I'm talking about long before the war. We don't have enough to say about Iran and Iranian foreign policy, and how Iran feeds Hamas, feeds Hezbollah, is determined to destroy the state of Israel. For example, we saw the young Israeli ambassador to Ireland, Dana Ehrlich, I think it's her first major posting. She's become an extremely isolated figure, not invited to the Fianna Fáil Ardèche, not invited to the Fine Gael Ardèche, but we did invite the Iranian ambassador to both of them at the Charge d'Affaires. He was on Drive Time the other day. Good, tough-minded interview on that programme. But it was kind of astonishing to me that we would think not to invite the Israeli ambassador, and that we would invite the Iranian ambassador to both of those events, as if the Iranian regime is unproblematic. We know that the Iranian regime is a horrible regime. It has been supporting terrorist outfits in the Middle East for years and years and years. It is an extremely destructive presence in the Middle East. It's extremely destructive towards its own people. We saw, for example, how that Kurdish woman who removed her headscarf ended up getting killed by regime police. And then there was major trouble out in the streets, which was eventually put down. So I can't understand how we can criticise Israel all the time, and often rightly, and give the likes of Iran a free pass and invite the Iranian ambassador.
I'm not sure we give Iran a free pass. Well,
yeah, but I mean, why would they get invited to the Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael Ardèche and you shun the Israelis? That doesn't show a proper even-handedness, in my opinion.
I wonder if it's to do with...
I don't think... I think Ireland are quite critical of other regimes. The Russian ambassador wasn't invited to either regimes, and I was driving past it on the way to a match the other night. Have you seen it, that there's graffiti on the walls, there's protests outside it constantly?
We're not talking about Russia.
There's a guard presence. Micheál Martin, 2 days ago, appealed to Iran to step back and to prevent escalation. Iran is a pariah state on the international stage. There are economic sanctions against Iran.
Yeah, but why invite the Iranian ambassador to the Fine Gael Ardèche and the Fianna Fáil Ardèche? I mean, so that implies that they are in good standing. There.
That's a question for both Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael.
Well, I'd like to hear the answer.
But Iran is a pariah state on the international stage. They're under huge economic sanctions.
Not to us. I mean, you have plenty of Irish politicians who are quite content to be photographed with the Iranian ambassador as if, you know, Iran is not a pariah state.
Example.
Niall Collins. Okay. Number of years ago, just to give one example.
Okay, number of years ago. Okay.
I wonder if the difference is because the Israeli government this week criticised Simon Harris's speech in the Dáil and Ireland's response, which is a very kind of... when we talk about diplomacy, that is actually a rare thing to happen, where an embassy or a government issues kind of criticism of the government in the country that they are representing. And that has happened a number of times. That might be the difference. But I do think it is also the public interest in Palestine, you know, that we see our own history reflected in that, and that we feel like it is wrong not to do anything we can just empathise with that position. So it's easier to almost understand the Palestinian cause than to get involved in the Iranian regime.
Yeah, but there can't be, but there can't be peace when you have Iran dedicated to the destruction of the state of Israel and Ireland not saying enough on that score. I mean, Ireland, there's only one small voice on the international scene, but it's trying to make itself as loud as it can. And it simply doesn't have enough to say about what actually creates the conditions of peace in that region. And one of the conditions for peace in that region is Iran stops backing the likes of Hezbollah and Hamas. I mean, that's obvious. And yes, of course Netanyahu ought to go in Israel and be replaced by a much better government and a much better prime minister. Israel is a democratic state, so that's possible. But there must be a much more pressure put on Iran to stop funding Hamas and to stop funding Hezbollah, which are both determined to destroy Israel.
But do we stand idly by when 34,000 people have been killed?
No.
Do we understand idly by 80% of the people at risk of famine in the world right now, according to the UN, or in immediate famine, or in the Gaza Strip? Do we stand idly by while aid cannot get into the Gaza Strip because of I think Ireland, I think we're very brave, and it's for small nations to stand up to this. And by the way, Micheál Martin was over.
Hamas aren't in favour of a two-state solution either, are they, Ciarán?
Well, they're not.
No.
They're not. They're determined to destroy the state of Israel. So again, we're all in favour of creating the conditions for peace in that region. But we've got to look at the other side of the equation. So Netanyahu and some of the very extremist elements in his government are a major, major, major problem. It'd be much better if somebody like Benny Gantz, who's the main opposition leader, was the Prime Minister of Israel. But part of what
as much as people don't support, I think two-thirds of people, I think at this stage, think Netanyahu should go.
Yeah, correct.
Two-thirds of Israelis also continue to support the war, don't they?
Correct, correct. So therefore, I mean, anybody who comes into power in Israel has to have Israeli security first and foremost. This is where international pressure comes in. But the international pressure can't bear down on one power only if we want to create overall conditions for peace.
Kate, did you want to come in there?
Just, it was shocking last night to see it unfold. And I suppose what struck me was, despite all of the conversations and even Simon Harris's comments last weekend and his very defined line, I mean, Irish people, to my mind, don't want to stand by and see innocents being murdered. We're heartbroken and we do identify with it from our own past, whether rightly or wrongly, we do identify with it.
And we identify with it in a very one-sided way.
Absolutely.
You'd agree with David, yeah.
But I think last night things changed. I mean, I saw it happening live, Tel Aviv and southern Israel, and I saw the RAF coming in and the Americans moving. And you're just going, OK, has this now become a what side are you on this thing? Have we all to pull back and go, we as a small country, as part of a wider European bloc, how are we part of the peaceful solution? Let's forget the intricacies of embassies and Hamas and who did this and Netanyahu and should we have a whole change? Ireland has a very, I suppose, we punch above our weight when it comes to peacekeeping and calling for peace. And I think we have to keep ploughing ahead with that to be on the right side of this.
Okay, but the right side, but it is a whose side are we on, and we have picked a side, have we?
I don't think yet, but I do think that last night changed things. I mean, 300 drones landing in on the Israelis and them having to blast them out of the sky to protect their people, on top of what the atrocities we've seen with the Palestinian people. It has to stop, and it has to be a stop has to be called internationally. Retaliation and offensives is not going to solve this.
Okay, I have to take a break. Kate O'Connell, Ciarán Macavir, Gráinne, and David Quinn are staying with us.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Kate O'Connell, Ciarán Macavir, Gráinne, and David Quinn are still with us. And I'm sorry we only have a few minutes for this, but it is important, and I know you all want to talk about it. David, the CAS report this week on the Tavistock gender services, you picked Mark Tighe's piece, but there's stuff across all the papers, aren't there?
Yeah, so Mark Tighe is on The Independent, has been doing tremendous work on this for a couple of years, and he's highlighted the kind of practices that the CAS report revealed. And what the CAS report is particularly concerned about, and you see the reason that has a very great relevance to Ireland is because the HSC has been sending children who have gender dysphoria over to the Tavistock clinic for treatment. So the big problem, I think, is the use of puberty blockers. and the fact that puberty blockers are scientifically unproven. And so you're using basically a very radical treatment on children that doesn't have proper scientific backup. And so people like Mark Tighe, and in particular Mark Tighe, have been trying to highlight this and quoting people like Professor Donald O'Shea, among others, who have been raising concerns about this. And you have various people as well saying, we need to have something like a CAS review here to see what we're doing and if we are treating the children who present themselves for care properly. And I'd certainly support that call. I mean, it seems a very sensible one to me.
Kate, you were looking at this too.
Yeah, I mean, the CAS report's very comprehensive, 32 recommendations. The summary, to my mind, of it is that puberty blockers should not be used under 18 unless there is a clear, defined clinical pathway. These drugs that are used are licensed for other things such as prostate cancer or delaying puberty in children that develop secondary sexual characteristics before 8 or 9 years of age. And this has become a very contentious issue nationally and globally. And what Cass has done is she's ripped it apart and she's moved down to the, to my mind, to the child protection area.
And medical.
It's yes, a medical but it is
report.
Medical.
Yeah.
This is various specialities, psychiatry, psychology and the endocrine system all working together. This just, and the concern that I have here is a move for the driving of health policy by online actors. Who is the influencer? How did it come to pass that children in this day and age were given medication under 18 that would alter or halt the reproductive system, and that anybody that spoke out against it, politicians shied away from this. I shy away from very little and I try to keep away from this, and myself and David wouldn't agree on many things, but on this issue politicians were afraid of it. If you look at the treatment of, is it Graham Lenehan,
okay,
Mr.
Yes,
Father Ted, you look at J.K. Yeah. Rowling.
Okay, look, I'm really sorry, I'm not sure that dealt with it was cancelled. Okay, they've dealt with it in various
but
ways,
it's, but it's important
this is
in
a very
terms of policy
issue.
Who is the influencer of health policy?
Okay, and look, I'm not shutting that down. We are, time is up. Kate O'Connell, Ciarán MacIvear, Grainne Nia, David Quinn, thank you all very much for that very lively hour.